Good morning, may it please the court. Judd Lawness, registration number 33208 on behalf of Lindsay Harding. Before I begin, I'd like to reserve any time I have remaining after my initial argument for the bottom. Your Honor, I strongly believe that all the issues raised in my brief have merit and happy answering questions about any of them. However, today I plan to focus on argument three, admissibility of the video of the forensic interview under 1325.129, because it presents a matter of first impression for this court. In People v. Newbrow, the Supreme Court held that a video recorded interview of a child victim of sexual assault is not admissible under the child deposition statute unless the prosecution complies with the procedural requirements of that one. The legislature then enacted paragraph 5 of the statute, which provided that nothing in this section shall prevent the admission of evidence of any videotaped statements of children which would qualify for admission under 1325.129. And then 1325.129, in turn, allows the admission only of statements made by a child describing any act of sexual contact, intrusion, or penetration. The statutory exception to the deposition statute is strictly confined to the statements described in 1325.129.
Mr. Lawless, let me ask you on this. Is it your position? Well, I guess the question is really, how strict do we read those words? I mean, can it really be that you can only put on that videotape that where a victim talks about contact, intrusion, or penetration? Don't you need some sort of context?
There is some context allowed. In that case, the case is People v. Cerna, which says, in my belief, stretch the meaning of 1325.129 to include attendant circumstances to the defendant's alleged sexual contact. So attendant circumstances, I suppose it doesn't need to be presented in a complete vacuum. The alleged victim might say, what he or she was wearing, where it occurred, the time, when. But prosecution doesn't get to make an hour and 19 long video statement about why they should win the case. That's not what 1325.129.
Can you tell me, counsel, what specifically is in this 1 hour 19 minute tape that goes beyond the attendant circumstances?
Absolutely, Your Honor. AH made statements about her relationship with her father, the fact that she loved him. He cried when she confronted him about the alleged abuse. That was not said to occur contemporaneously with the alleged abuse. That's a whole separate incident. Her brother, who nearly always stayed in the same house in an adjoining room, was apparently a heavy sleeper. Therefore, she testified that he wouldn't have heard anything. She testifies about her mother, the family dynamics. She testifies about statements.
Why wouldn't that be a circumstance that might be an attendant circumstance to the crime? My brother wouldn't hear anything because he was X, or he was deaf, or he was sleeping. Why wouldn't that be, kind of like normally you think, well, if the brother's in the house, he should know something. Well, why isn't that an attendant circumstance?
Yeah, it is relevant, of course, and it's something that she could have testified to. Okay, but it's not, you're just, when the statute says a statement made by a child describing any act of sexual contact, intrusion, or penetration, when she starts talking about her brother, whether he's a heavy sleeper or not, I mean, that you've kind of blown beyond any statutory limitation whatsoever. I mean, those words have meaning. And when the legislature wrote the statute, it specifically confined it to the acts of sexual abuse.
They do have meaning, but I thought that since Cerna, we've decided, or I thought divisions of this court have applied that statute not as literal as you suggest.
Never, Your Honor. Never once. This is a matter of first impression. This court, in no published decision, has ever gone beyond Cerna.
Well, let me ask you a slightly different question, Mr. Lawness, and just a procedural concern. The argument you're now making about Cerna, I'm not sure you made it until your reply brief here before us. Cerna is cited once in the opening brief as a CF site that says defendant no call report is upheld the admission of a tape where the defendant clearly objected to admission of statements falling outside the scope. You draw out the argument for the first time in the reply brief. Is this preserved for us here?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We objected specifically on this ground in the trial court. We said, this is not admissible. In my opening brief, I said, these statements are beyond the scope. Because I merely point out that it's a matter of first impression, the reply brief doesn't mean I haven't raised it
my concern, again, and you've been in front of us plenty, and you've seen me go after both sides on this kind of issue. My concern is that you make a very strong argument in your reply brief that this needs to be limited, and you tell us about the intended circumstances, but that's not in your opening brief, and I'm concerned about that.
Your Honor, I believe in my opening brief I explain that it does not permit, the exception applies only to statements following the 1325.129, i.e. describing any act of sexual contact, intrusion, or penetration. And then I go on to list the parts that fall outside of that.
I see what you're saying. Okay, I'm with you. Thank you.
The opening brief is limited, and I understand why, to 9,500 words, and I necessarily, I'm not sure what the people are going to respond to, what the response might be, but when I got the response, I believe I responded appropriately.
I understand. Thank you.
Here we have an hour, 19-minute video tape, essentially ex parte deposition. This is the very type of hearsay that has always been found to be most unreliable.
Does the surplusage in your mind support the credibility of the child?
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor. Because she talks about her relationship with two other people who she made an outcry to, her theology teacher and her boyfriend. She explains why she decided to come forward and when. She testifies that her father showed her porn on her computer and later destroyed that porn to cover his tracks, cover up evidence of the crime. It contains her statement that her dad is sick because he suggested that she could prostitute herself if she wanted to. It also contains the many bolstering statements of the forensic interviewer, which we also specifically objected to.
Let me ask you this, counsel. Those last portions that you just mentioned, very significant portions, were they also testified to by the victim in the case on the stand such that they may have been cumulative to that testimony?
No, Your Honor. And in my opening brief, I note the fact that the prosecutor, she had... this is a one-day trial, essentially. I think it spilled over into 2 days, the evidentiary phase, but it was essentially a one-day trial. She had very cursory testimony. She testified not to whole new events that she never disclosed before, but then she also, and then they simply rolled the tape where she couldn't be cross-examined, and it was damaging. It was so damaging and so probative that the prosecutor actually, in his closing argument, mostly referred to the Lisa Sungate videotape rather than her trial testimony. He referred 15 separate times, I counted, to the Sungate video and quoted from it extensively. So, and to prove...
Did he quote from sections outside what you consider the scope to be?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I also have those cited in my opening brief. She talks about how she's going to miss her father, how she loves him, she misses him playing guitar, camping, going for camping trips in his bus. He says, if this is a false allegation, why is she saying on this forensic interview how much she loves him? Why is she saying that? These are clearly not intended circumstances to the sexual assault, and it's very damaging. This court has addressed this issue in a few opinions, but it has never, ever allowed over objection this type of testimony. This is essentially an ex parte affidavit. The very type of hearsay that's considered most damaging, it's what the confrontation clause was designed to avoid getting into trial.
Well, let me ask you that, Mr. Owens. I mean, you knew when the court admitted this videotape before trial. You had a lengthy opportunity, not you, the defense counsel had a lengthy opportunity to cross-examine the victim here. I'm not sure what the confrontation clause issue is. I understand you made the objection, the defense made the objection here. So where's the issue? I mean, if the victim here wants to say any of this stuff, you get your shot at it. And you had a full shot cross-examining her.
Well, it would be a bit inconsistent to before the prosecution has introduced any evidence in this videotape to then question the alleged victim about statements to which we have objected and have not yet been admitted.
Could you have asked to recall the victim?
Well, by the time the videotape was played, she was dismissed, released as a witness, and allowed to remain in the courtroom.
But you could have anticipated that the videotape was going to be played, and you could have asked the judge, release her subject to recall, couldn't you, but the defense counsel.
Indeed, Your Honor, but that's not the duty of the defendant. It's the confrontation clause requires the people to call a witness to present the evidence through them. It's the right to compulsory process is distinct from that.
It didn't seem to me you want to question the victim about whether she loved her father or not, which is a lot of this evidence that came in outside the scope.
Your Honor, that's but one piece of the 15 references.
I understand. Some of the things that she says that may have increased her credibility or in the eyes of many, you would not want to cross-examine about it.
Well, that's a good point, Your Honor. I mean, we do not necessarily want to highlight these statements. We were objecting to them. So I think that's why we would not want to call her. And we objected to them because we didn't want the people to present them and what I call a video to show why they win their case. I think every litigant would like to do that. 1325.129 simply doesn't allow that. I know that the court does not necessarily need to reach this issue because this videotape is simply not admissible under the district court factors anyway. The statements were made after AH made statements to her mother, which the court ruled were inadmissible under 1325.129, because they were a product of leading questions. After that inadmissible statement, the police investigation began, and her mother and the detective drove her down to Sungate for this interview. The statements were clearly not spontaneous. They were not made when AH was still upset or pained from the alleged abuse. It may have been involved language that a 15-year-old would typically use, but so what? How does that lend to her credibility? One of the issues is whether the allegation was made in response to a leading question. And I'd argue here that the entire procedure was in fact a leading question. 15-year-old knows exactly what's going on, what she's supposed to say, especially after her mom has essentially initiated this investigation with leading questions of her own.
Let me make sure I understood you. So is your concern the interviewer asked leading questions or mom asked leading questions which set the chain of events in motion?
The interviewer did not ask particularly leading questions.
Right. Isn't that when we're looking at the, I understand your argument about mom, I get that. But don't we have to look at for the district court factors whether the interviewer asked leading questions?
I don't think this court has to be blind to the realities of the investigative process in the judicial system. Clearly she made a statement which was inadmissible under 1325.129. She then goes
to the... Do you have any authority indicating that that statement tainted any subsequent statement?
I don't think we've ever had a case where it's been presented so starkly, Your Honor, where the court finds sequentially that one statement is inadmissible under 1325.129, and then a week later, another statement is. I think it's very clear that it is tainted, and that was the argument we made below.
Wouldn't that be just one factor to consider, not it's tainted as a matter of law?
Your Honor, I think it is one factor, it's a multi-factor test, but I think what my argument is, if you look at the balance of the factors and consider the reality of what's going on here, it's clearly not, your job is not to determine whether you believe age or not. Your job is to determine whether the time, content, and circumstances made it a guaranteed reliability. We simply don't have that in this case. Your Honor, I'd like your name. I reserve my additional privileges.
You're not going to, counsel. but I will give you some more time, and I will give the people some more time. I have two questions I'd like you to try to address. The first question is has to do with, I think it was the first issue raised in your brief, about the inability to bring out the evidence about the context in which she actually made her initial outcry about her father. That's the first question. And the second question I have is kind of switching streams as a basis of conviction. Could that have been a permissible constructive amendment? I get mixed up permissible and impermissibles because it conforms to the evidence presented in the case. So, Your Honor.
Okay, Your Honor. First question first. Your Honor, I believe this case is on all fours with Davis v. Alaska and your opinion in the Owens case. She had a motive to falsely accuse her father, and that was abundantly apparent from the whole context of the testimony about that outcry. She went to talk to Ms. Larson. She spent the first some hour and 10, hour and 15 minutes discussing her guilt, her feelings of shame, wondering if she's going to be condemned by God because she's been having sexual relations with a number of boys. And that's why she was crying throughout this whole conversation with her theology teacher in this class when they were doing sexuality and stressing abstinence. By the time they, an hour and 15 minutes, she said, I'm doing this because my dad has been sexually abusing her. And the defense attorney in the pretrial hearing put a very fine point on it. She asked her, she said, did she tell you, I'm doing these things with other boys because of what my dad did to me? And she answered, yes. We then filed a rape motion once the court said it was going to admit Ms. Larson's testimony. At trial, the prosecution was allowed to permit an entirely skewed version of this statement. We hear that she's crying for an hour and 15 minutes, you know, really, really emotionally difficult time with the teacher. And we even ask her, but you did not go in there to ask about your dad, did you? That was not the topic of conversation. And she said, yes, I did. Well, that was not what the testimony of Ms. Larson we were allowed to present it. And as in Davis v. Alaska, A.H. was allowed to give questionably untruthful statements on cross-examination because the court's pre-trial ruling, which disallowed us from questioning her about her bias and motive. The second question, Your Honors, regarding the constructive amendment. I believe that this case is different from the typical case because of the procedural posture. I believe that when the people came out and said, this is what the basis of the charges are, 1 through 5, and then correspondingly 6 through 10, and the court denied motion for bill of particular on that ground, and where the charges had a 6-year span, and where the alleged victim is 15 years old, 16, I believe, at the time of testifying, I believe we were entitled to rely on that statement. And we were allowed to present our defense and question the witness to disprove what the people said were the basis of the charges.
Well, let me ask, and I know we're giving you some extra time here. But as I remember it, the people kind of, they vehemently objected to having given a kind of bill of particulars, and they kind of kept saying, for purposes of this hearing, here's what we're going to go on. And the judge said, look, at the end of the case, if I find 5 separate instances, I'm going to find 5 separate instances, and then deny the bill of particulars. There's a lot of law, I know, that says if there's a bill of particulars, then they can't deviate from that. Here, it seems to me, you're kind of arguing a de facto bill of particulars, and that's why we have an alleged constructive amendment. And I'm just not sure what law would support that. The bill of particulars was denied. The case law says that people get to elect after their evidence, and that's what happened. I mean, here, the charges were very broad, and they were identical charges, just listed the elements of the statute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think you're arguing to us that there was a de facto bill of particulars, and they're bound by that. I'm not sure what case law supports that.
I am arguing that, Your Honor, and I've cited a couple of federal cases and a case from New Hampshire, People v. Or State v. Allison, in support of that. And with respect to Colorado law on those issues, it's very clear that, you know, the defendant is supposed to get notice from the information, from the and from the PH, from discovery. And here what we had at trial was, because the DA simply chose not to ask AH any questions, I mean, he never talked to her. What we had was AH was testifying about things the DA had never heard about, were never presented in discovery, were not part of the PH and not part of the charging document. And I really failed to see, and I might recall it as an epistemological matter, how can you charge someone? How could he have charged someone in 2009 with something he doesn't even know about until 2010? He cannot, as a matter of law, be part of the charge.
Let me ask you, counsel, this. Wasn't the reason why a bill of particulars wasn't given in this case because the DA had said, hey, we told you about this before?
That's right.
That was my understanding.
That's what I understand, too, Your Honor.
You haven't argued, however, that the trial court here is denying a bill of particulars.
That's because I think I believe we got this.
You think you got notice, but then they departed from the notice.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, counsel, I think we've tortured you enough. I will give you 2 extra minutes in for rebuttal, and I will give you 22 minutes, and you may need it, or you may not.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Because believe it or not, we did torture you for an extra 5 minutes, and so we'll give you 2 more on rebuttal, but we'll give her 22 in the event we decide to torture her as well.
So we can torture you more.
That's right.
As long as it's you.
Wait one last second. Judge Gabriel, I actually interrupted you. Did you want to ask another question of Mr.
No, Holmes? It's fine. Thank you.
I apologize.
I got 2 more minutes to torture myself.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. Nicole Wiggins, registration number 42702, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. And Your Honors, I'm going to start with the rape shield evidence, because that's where we sort of left off there. And I want to point out a few things that were already discussed, but the evidence here is exactly the type of evidence that's meant to be excluded by the rape shield statute, and as such, it was properly excluded in this case. Essentially, what the defendant was trying to do here is say that the victim was seeking to escape some sort of judgment, some sort of shame, some sort of guilt from her outside sexual behavior that had nothing to do with the defendant or allegations in this case.
Well, why not? Well, how is this case different from, I think it was Owens, the case Judge Daly wrote? And in that case, you know, the facts were the defendant the boyfriend walks in on his girlfriend having sex with the defendant. The girlfriend then says, he raped me, because she wants to preserve her relationship. Here, the evidence was quite strong. I mean, the teacher testified, well, Mr. Watts correctly, you know, stated the teacher's testimony. The victim comes in and crying, having been in this course on abstinence. The teacher's her mentor. And she's saying, I'm afraid God is mad at me. And she's talking all and racked with guilt about having relations with other boys. And then she says, I did this because of what my father did to me. She makes the causal connection. The teacher was unequivocal about that and dead honest about that. Why doesn't that establish, you can argue that, and the jury may say, that's a bunch of malarkey, but why doesn't that at least establish some evidence that there was a motive to lie? She's concerned about preserving her relationship with her teacher, who she cares deeply about, her mentor. She's concerned God is mad at her. You know, she's going to burn in hell because of what she did, racked with guilt. Why isn't that some evidence of motive? Why is that, you know, Rape Shield says we can't look at any of that?
Well, for one thing, Your Honor, you know, the teacher reassures her, you know, I'm not mad at you, God's not mad at you. So in that respect, any sort of fear or judgment that could potentially be driving this is quashed very quickly. The other thing I want to point out is that I think the difference here is that she's saying that the pure sex was a motive to come forward, not a motive to fabricate. That her father...
I think that's fairly close. I think she's saying, I thought, as I read the argument, I thought they were saying kind of like, and again, judgment. She may have said, I don't judge you, but we're all humans and we all come away with impressions from people. And so there still may have been concern on this young woman's part that her theology teacher may have had an adverse impression of her. And therefore said, it's not my fault. It's not my fault. I wouldn't have done this if it wasn't for somebody else. Why can't it be read that way? Why can't a jury reasonably consider those circumstances as potentially supporting that theory?
Your Honor, there's just not a whole lot besides her, and the victim does come out and say, yeah, I was just kind of saying that to get to talking about my father. And there's just not a whole lot of evidence, you know, that she's feeling a whole lot of peer pressure from the outside. And what it really looks like is a child coming forward and not really knowing how to say it at first and then saying it. And the teacher did kind of testify that, you know, that's what was happening. When she started discussing her father, things changed significantly. And I think part of the difference in Owens here, between this case and Owens, is in Owens we just have much more substantial evidence that there's a particular relationship that this young woman is trying to save and that it is under attack based on something. And there's just no evidence here that her outside life was really under attack. She may have felt guilty about what she did, but there's no evidence that that would cause her to just make something up like this.
But couldn't a jury reach that conclusion? I understand your argument, and it would be, you know, make a pretty strong argument to a jury to that effect. And you can, I don't, spin is not the right word, but you can certainly spin that to say, look, this is really, you know, a way to get to the really difficult issue she wants to address. I totally understand that. But really picking up on Judge Daly's question, couldn't a reasonable jury see it otherwise, that she came in racked with guilt? It really was about her guilt about, you know, having relations with her peers, having been in a class about abstinence where her mentor is saying you shouldn't do that. Could not a reasonable jury say she was so racked with guilt that she then, you know, made up this allegation to excuse her conduct?
I mean, I suppose, Your Honor, there's always a possibility that a couple of jurors could be receptive to any argument. I mean, in this case, I don't see how there's enough relevancy to get past the Rape Shield statute.
Isn't there an inference? Couldn't the jury draw an inference from the Judge Gabriel's characterization of the discussion that the father was secondary and was, in fact, to justify the former?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, so could the jury form an inference that...
that the guilt related to the friends and was the father was raised as an excuse?
But it's very tenuous, Your Honor, especially when we don't really have any evidence of this outside sexual activity. You know, there's no further discussion of it because it's very clear that it's not relevant, excuse me, to what she's getting at. So in that respect, we don't even really know what she's talking about. She never really fleshes it out. So, and you know, the reason being is...
Well, the teacher seemed to be under the impression that she was saying, I did these things with other boys because my dad did them to me or with me. And the teacher seemed to make a connection there.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I believe the connection the teacher made is that the child is acting out based on what she says happened to her. So I think that the teacher is making the connection of this child is acting out sexually because she's being sexually abused. So I think that's the connection that the teacher was making. And there's just no evidence, you know, particularly beyond that conversation, of any sort of fear on the child's part that someone's going to come down on her. And the pure sex issue really just falls to the wayside because she never fleshes it out. We're not even sure this happened. There's just no evidence that she came out and would go through this process just because she feels guilty. Other than the child kind of being in a religious environment, we don't have a whole lot of outside evidence that that's what's going on.
Isn't that for the jury to determine what's going on? What motivates her to come and make these statements? Isn't that for the jury to determine what's going on?
Why
she would make this?
It's for the jury to take the relevant evidence and to determine what was going on. And in this case, this evidence was just not relevant, particularly under the rape shield statute.
Has no tendency to make probable or less probable a fact and consequence her motive for having gone to the teacher and cried for an hour and 15 minutes.
Your Honor, and I think it's important to distinguish her motive.
You're absolutely right. Actually, her motive for talking about something else for an hour and 15 minutes.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you clarify what you're saying there? I lost you.
Yeah, it has no tendency to make more or less probable the girl's motive to essentially blame Dad for why I've been in here crying and letting you know something else for an hour and 15 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So, and I think in concluding sort of this topic, Your Honor, I think it's important to take in the overall protective scope of the rape shield statute and that the evidence is presumptively irrelevant. And she's talking about sexual activity that doesn't involve the defendant. And what the defendant is essentially trying to do is say the victim was promiscuous. She felt bad about that promiscuity and blame me for it. And that's exactly what the rape shield statute is trying to keep out. And so in this case, it was properly excluded.
I have one more question.
Sure, Your Honor.
To move on. You would agree that the rape shield statute has an exception if there's relevant evidence that's relevant to a material fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you would agree that you don't disagree with there's case law out there that talks about motive as one.
Yes.
Agreed. So you're saying is there insufficient evidence here to establish this motive, and the case is distinguishable from the others?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And in the cases cited by defendant in regards to this issue, there was always something outside force acting on the child where we had a lot more evidence. I think in one case the defendant cited the child was physically abused for her sexual activity. In those cases, there's just a lot more evidence of an outside influence working on the child where there's concrete evidence that she's developed a motive. Here, the child always maintained that she loved her father. There was just no indication that there was a motive, such as the child seeking to avoid physical pain from another parent. So I think it's distinguishable on those factors, Your Honor. In regards to the video hearsay that counsel discussed earlier, just to touch on that a little bit, and Your Honor has pointed out several things, but just to solidify those, I do want to point out both the victim and the interviewer testified at length and were subject to cross-examination. The video was available prior to the victim's testimony. It is necessary in these videos to have some rapport building, and that was important in this case. And the interviewer was there to testify, and he did testify, hey, in the beginning when I asked her, you know, what is your relationship with your mother? And what is your relationship with your brother? He informed the jury, these are rapport building things. This is just so the child can become comfortable. And so the jury was explained, you know, what was going on in that respect. And a lot of that, you know, didn't contain any sort of objectionable statements. And the attendant circumstances are necessary to prove an adequate description of the abuse. And in this case, several, you know, where this happened, who was around, whether her brother was there, whether he was sleeping, you know. In fact, in Cerna, I believe the pornography shown to the victim during the offenses, which is also what we have here, was also found to be admissible. So those kind of things that are going on in the background while this abuse is going on, those are necessary and relevant to provide the jury with a complete picture of the story. And in this case, the court properly admitted those, And the overall value of the video, the time, content, and circumstances in this case, provided extensive reliability, especially when this, and this in a way, I mean, it's a very prepared interview, but it's prepared very open-endedly. So did she know she would be there? Of course she did. But the questions are designed to ask very open-ended, blind kind of interview questions. And I do want to point out that while she's not a child, and a lot of our child hearsay laws distinguish based on age and whatnot, and we do seem to give some more leniency to children, she's not an adult either. So I think that does need to be taken into consideration when we're assessing the overall reliability of the hearsay statements.
Can I ask you on this, Ms.
Yes, Ms.
Where would you draw the line? I mean, Cerna, at least, so arguably dicta, I suppose, drew something of a line. And Cerna, the concern was the victim's, you know, statements regarding the victim's reaction to the father's actions, how it made the victim feel. The court indicated some concern about that. I fully understand your argument about attendant circumstance. I'm just not sure, where would we draw the line? What crosses the line? What's beyond attendant circumstances in your view?
Right, Your Honor. And I'm sure that would be a wavy, curvy line if we were to draw it. I don't think you can draw a bright line rule, as in most things that we're dealing with in the law. But I do think that would be a scenario wherein the victim perhaps brings out things that aren't charged. In this case, there was some redaction, and they removed some comments that the victim made about the defendant previously being incarcerated. Stuff like that, I think, definitely crosses the line when you're talking about uncharged criminal conduct, and it becomes almost a 404B issue as well. And so I think with that kind of stuff, you draw the line. I do think it's terribly difficult to do that because the jury does need a complete picture, and you can't just put frame one, you know, victim described oral sex, frame two, victim describes more oral sex. There needs to be attendant circumstances, and I think the victim is entitled to that in a way, so that their allegations aren't really being taken out of context when they're presented to the jury. But in terms of limiting it, we can't have 3 or 4 hour videos where the victim goes on and on about, you know, other relationships extensively, stuff like that. I understand that there has to be a line, and I think that's a hard line to draw. I think the hardest line I can take now is anything that's uncharged, something like the defendant being previously in jail or anything like that needs to be taken out. Other than that, I do believe it's a case-by-case scenario. That's why trial courts are provided such discretion on this issue, so that they can see, and the general character of the child is to be taken into consideration as well. So I think that's why we give the court such discretion. I don't know how hard of a line we can draw.
Were there any questions in this interview to the child, such as, are you being truthful to us now? Was that on the video?
Your Honor, I do not specifically recall that being in the video. I don't recall that either party alleged that as an issue, but I don't recall if they specifically asked that.
I'm just wondering on the credibility building part that Judge Roy had asked about, and I wondered whether or not would that be a line that should be drawn, that those types of things should be redacted?
Your Honor, I think there could be an argument for that. I think maybe one or two comments along those lines maybe would be okay, but if an interviewer persists in getting a victim to keep telling, you know, saying, I'm telling the truth, I foresee how there could be an issue with that if it's repeated.
And why should that be allowed the first time?
Pardon?
Why should that be allowed the first time?
Well, Your Honor, I think it really depends on the case. I think if it's one sentence in a whole video, that might not, is entwined with what the victim's saying, then I think...
What's that got to do with what the victim's saying? That's kind of like, in addition to the circumstances, let me tell you, you can believe me. What's that got to do? As far as for our jury's concern, why should the jury need to hear or see that?
I guess, Your Honor, I'm not saying the jury absolutely needs to see that. I'm just saying, ordinarily, comments like that are part and parcel to what's being stated, which is extremely relevant and needs to be seen.
Making.
What is the meaning of the statute 1325.129 which limits this testimony to sexual contact, intrusion, or penetration. The use of these out-of-court statements.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, like, what is the purpose of that statute?
What is the meaning of 1325.129, which appears to limit out-of-court statements to statements of contact, intrusion, or penetration?
The meaning of that...
Limitation.
The statute, counsel, I'm assuming I can help. It says, an out-of-court statement made by a child describing any act of sexual contact, intrusion, or penetration. That's the first sentence of the statute.
Yes.
Mr. Ronis's argument that it's limited, more limited than you're suggesting. So, I guess, Judge...
Does that mean sexual contact and anything else that the child has to say about other things?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. It is, the statute states sexual contact. It has been interpreted by courts to mean sexual content and the attendant circumstances necessary to explain those. So yes, most definitely it should be intended and as limited as it can be presented to the jury, sexual contact. As I stated, Your Honor, I do think the trial court was right in this case, though, in that you can't just give a frame by frame of the sexual contact. That, in a way, violates the rule of completeness, and the jury is just getting a cut-up version. And as the trial court stated, and I agree, they're entitled to more than that. So, ideally it is just those statements, but in actuality, when a child is describing a sexual assault, it isn't going to be three or four succinct sentences. It's going to be an emotional telling. And some of those attendant circumstances are necessary for the jury to understand what happened. But yes, the statute in its...
So this interview was limited to the sexual contacts and the attendant circumstances surrounding those contacts?
Yes, Your Honor. There was rapport building. There was questions about the general family dynamic. That is all very normal for a forensic interview. That kind of sets the stage, and I guess lets the jury know how this happened in a way. And, you know, was the brother there?
How the act happened or how the interview happened? You know, there's a difference between kind of like, how did the act happen? That might be within the statute. How the interview happened, is that, you know, that seems to be a little bit further away. Counsel, I think I understand your arguments on this. I would like you, if you could, to address the issue about, gee, we have some new evidence and some new incidents, which apparently the prosecution focuses on to attain a couple of convictions.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. I do want to start out with the bill of particulars issue because I do think that is forecloses the defendant's argument. There was no bill of particulars, and the prosecution just can't be held to one. I think it's
let me ask you, why can't the prosecution be held to have essentially said, you don't need a bill of particulars, it's unnecessary because this is what we're relying on, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And when you go to trial and say, well, it's really not 4 and 5, we're relying on 6 and 7 for 4 and 5.
Which had never been stated.
To me, the question is like, okay, it's not a you denied me the bill of particulars, type of issue. It's the prosecution saying you don't need one because we've told them the specific incidents. Isn't there a little unfair play going on here?
Your Honor, I guess I don't recall the prosecution saying you don't need one. I think their words were to the extent there is a bill of particulars. So I guess I would find it a little unfair to hold the people to that where in their speech and in their writing, it was conditional. They said for purposes of today when they first laid out these counts. And the court made it clear, essentially the court was asking for an election essentially for the edification of the court, not intending to be binding. No one ever labeled or called them a binding election of charges. And also the motion that the people filed was in response to an allegation that there had been perjury at the preliminary hearing. So to the extent that it's repeated there, it's just a repetition of the testimony. And the people just never labeled it, called it, or presented it as a bill of particulars. And I think that's key when moving forward, you know, when the court's saying, well, if I file separate counts, I'll find, if I see enough evidence, I'll find the separate counts. And defense counsel understands at that point, you know, there is no bill of particulars. It was all kind of just to clarify things for the parties for preliminary hearing. But I don't believe with something as binding and, I guess, problematic as a bill of particulars can be for the prosecution, that we can treat it as such in this case when they never sat down and laid it out as such.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your argument. Your time has expired. Please put 2 minutes and 30 seconds on the rebuttal from Mr. Lomas. No, hold on. 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Sorry.
Thank you, Your Honors. In response to the child hearsay statute argument, I want to state that CERNA held that certain statements were inadmissible under 13251.29. Those were the ones identified in that case, which, of course, because they were at issue in the case, were the victim's reaction to his father's conduct, how he didn't feel about his father, and the reason why he delayed telling him. And those are sometimes precisely what was contained in the videotape in this case, and very akin to the extraneous information that we objected to in this case. So I believe Judge Roy had the correct question is what do those words mean in the statute, 13251.29, does the statute have an interpretation?
Why can't the term sexual act be interpreted almost like race gesti of sexual act? The things around the sexual act, the attendant circumstances.
Yeah, because this statute is a derogation of the common law and therefore must be strictly construed in favor of the defense. Regarding the argument one, regarding the rape shield statute, I just want to point out to the court that the error in this case is particularly egregious because after securing a ruling on the rape shield statute, in closing argument, the prosecutor then told the jury, there's no motive in this case. And ladies and gentlemen, if there's no motive to falsely accuse, then these sex assaults occurred. It cannot be harmless. It smacks, frankly, of unfair play. And accordingly, Your Honor, I'm asking you to reverse the judgments of conviction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, painless.
Counsel will...
That was short of painless.
The case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course. Before we leave, though, I want to thank both of you for your excellent arguments under adverse circumstances. Both of you, thank you very much for your arguments. Thank you.